From WBEZ Chicago, I'm Natalie Moore, and this is Making Stories Without End. Here, I take you on a journey to learn about daytime soap operas and their broad reach on television. Many people don't know that the serial started right here in Chicago. Join me as we talk about the social impact, history, and lasting legacy of television's unique immersive storytelling. Network television would not exist if not for the financial profit of soap operas. My love of soaps is not rendering me hyperbolic. Soaps brought in most of the money from the 1960s through the 1980s. The revenue allowed experimentation for some of the most lauded primetime sitcoms, ones we still talk about today. The decline of soaps isn't attributable to a singular event. Media fragmentation and evolving viewer habits tell that story. In this episode, we talk about the apex and the decline of soaps, but also their enduring legacy today. That emotional pull that non-fans are oblivious to because they think soaps are only campy, and they use that term, campy, to be dismissive. But they're wrong, because camp isn't bad. Soaps perfected storylines like Reva Shane confronting her clone on Guiding Light.
You can't be here now. Sorry to disappoint you, but I am. I am back, and it's over now. Reva, you got that right.
Feminist writer Susan Sontag famously wrote in defense of the camp aesthetic, "Soaps are outrageous, fusing elements of high and popular culture." Sontag dismissed people who deemed work too good to be camp or too important to be camp. Camp isn't naive. Camp knows it's camp. Soaps can camp with the best of them. I was stunned to read in soap historian Elena Levine's book that during the 1970s, soaps brought in 75% of the network's revenue. 75%. Can you even imagine? That, in effect, subsidized primetime. Executives at the time admitted as much.
In 1970, I believe, there were 19 soaps across, and we're talking three networks, right? ABC, NBC, CBS. And so that's an incredible, huge chunk of their schedule. And that's also the year that All in the Family and MASH and Mary Tyler Moore all start. And those are, you know, kind of famous shows for really experimenting and doing new things in primetime television storytelling. And I love those shows, and I'm thrilled that they exist. But I also love the idea that that incredibly lucrative daytime schedule that nobody was really paying that much attention to is actually what we have to thank for the networks being able to afford to take a risk on some of these new primetime shows.
Soaps were the most popular and most profitable between the mid-1960s and the mid-1980s. Primetime also saw dollar signs and created nighttime soaps such as Dynasty, Dallas, Falcon Crest, and Knott's Landing. As for daytime soaps, the audience grew with young people, college students. Soaps were never just for so-called housewives.
I mean, soaps were a legitimate kind of pop culture sensation. And as a result, the networks are able to charge more for those ad slots. And just advertisers start to get excited about that audience. It's a way to reach young people in particular for a time. And they were willing to pay more because what they were paying was still a whole lot less than what primetime TV cost them in terms of advertising time. And so having that ability to bring in more and more money through those ad sales really helped those networks because the production costs, even though they went up some over the years in soap opera production, again, still never at the level of what it costs to make a primetime show, in part because they were produced almost entirely in studios with standing sets in a very efficient production machine that would churn out at least an episode a day.
Ken Corday's father, Ted, created Days of Our Lives with Erna Phillips in 1965. After his father's sudden death a year later, his mother, Betty, took over. he joined the family business in the 1980s.
We used to say that, you know, our show was made it possible for a lot of pilots and other shows to be made at Network. I might have my hand slapped for saying that.
No, he wouldn't get his hand slapped for saying that. He's a truth teller, in the same vein as the matriarch Maggie on Days of Our Lives. The height of ad sales in soaps was 1980, $1.2 billion. The backbone of this phenomenon was Erna Phillips, and people downplayed that for years. One of the reasons I wanted to do this podcast was to give a history corrective, and part of that is giving Phillips public flowers. This Chicago woman's creation in 1930 about a core family surviving the trials and tribulations of daily life has not been immortalized enough, not even by the broader television industry. Scholars note that fellow Chicago native Bill Paley, the media mogul who built CBS television into the Tiffany Network, didn't even mention Phillips in his autobiography, yet she was a key moneymaker. The soap world validated Phillips. Her protégés, Agnes Nixon and William Bell, did. Bell's son, Brad, agrees that a larger appreciation of Phillips is overdue.
Well, I think that she told soulful stories that, you know, reflected the times. But, you know, she was also interested in pushing the times forward, which she did with her stories. And she was really, and my dad and Agnes, too, all doing, you know, the ones who were doing issue stories and stories that would shape people's minds and hopefully open people's minds. And no, I don't think she has the credit that she deserves. And the story needs to be told.
The savvy single mother changed the face of television by creating a genre that has worlds without end. Part Dickens, part Greek tragedy, part vixen, part socially conscious. The impact is indelible. But Phillips's fade to black was not on her own volition. She wrote in her autobiography that when As the World Turns had low ratings, the supervisor of the program held her responsible for the dip. It was 1972, and during this time, live hearings of this monumental event broadcasted on television, preempting daytime.
If the many allegations made to this date are true, then the burglars who broke into the headquarters of the Democratic National Committee at the Watergate were in effect breaking into the home of every citizen of the United States.
On July 1st, Phillips celebrated her 72nd birthday. She was informed by the head of daytime television for Procter & Gamble that her contract had been voided. Phillips said she was told that two other writers were hired to take over As the World Turns. I have certainly not asked to be released from my contract, she wrote. On the following Monday, for the first time, no script was written by Phillips. For 43 years, Phillips was the queen of soaps. She originated, wrote, or supervised more than a dozen daytime serials. It's estimated that she wrote 2 million words a year, the equivalent of 40 novels. The same year she was fired, Phillips died. After the break, I'll bust a myth about why soap operas declined, one you've probably heard too. What led to the cancellation of soaps? There's a common theory repeated more often than a Law & Order franchise rerun. This 1995 trial of the century shoulders the blame.
We, the jury, in the above entitled action, find the defendant Orenthal James Simpson not guilty of the crime of murder in violation of Penal Code Section 187A, a felony upon Nicole Brown Simpson, a human being.
Conventional wisdom goes like this. The O.J. Simpson trial interrupted the daytime schedule preempting soaps. Viewers broke the habit of daily watching, and the ratings glided downward like a child on a playground slide. I used to repeat that claim. I heard it so many times, I thought it made sense. Soap historian Elena Levine is a bit dubious about Simpson being the major factor.
Not all soaps were interrupted. Some soaps, like that aired, say, during the lunch break of the trial, were on still every day during that period. There have been interruptions in soaps in the past for other kinds of events. Watergate is definitely one of them, and the audience comes back. So I just don't know that that interruption alone is enough. People also talk about, oh, the real world drama was, you know, more interesting than the fictional drama. It was a compelling story, obviously. I just don't buy that no one ever cared about fictional storytelling again after that. It just doesn't make sense.
Ken Corday knocks down the OJ theory too.
The judge, Judge Ito, gaveled for recess every day at noon. And it just so happened that, of course, Days was on at that time. And we never lost a beat. The show continued to air without stopping, in that many of the other shows were preempted or stopped because the trial went on. And it was curious that Judge Ito had, I think, about 15 or 20 small hourglasses on the judge's bench.
Like sands through the hourglass, so are the days of our lives.
So, the joke around the studio was perhaps he's a Days fan and wants to watch Days every day during the trial.
Plus, in the late 1990s, NBC and ABC created new soaps. They have done that if they thought soaps would never return from the so-called dead? Doubtful. In fact, the city started a month after the OJ verdict. Soap cancellations were a slow drip. The waning unfolded like crumpled laundry.
When you start to look at the ratings data over the years, you see that by the late 80s, that peak starts to go down. There's so many factors. I think that the biggest factor is just the changes in broadcast television more broadly, which we see very clearly now with the rise of streaming. But streaming didn't come out of thin air, right? There were changes going on with television from really the 80s and the rise of cable that have taken, you know, several decades to get to where we are now.
Corday says soaps benefited from appointment television.
People would set their classes around watching the soaps, ask a friend to videotape the soap on a VCR so they could watch it later. You know, it was very much appointment television, and there were far more people watching it because of that. You know, repeats weren't available. You couldn't go back as you can today with Peacock streaming and look at episodes from a year or two back. So yes, it was the champagne days of, sorry to use that word, but happy to use that word. The champagne days of soaps were the 80s and 90s.
I see changing television in my own household. When my 8-year-old daughter Skye was homesick from school, I joked that she had to watch The Young and the Restless and give me a recap. She unequivocally told me she had other stuff to watch. She did not want to be a part of a new generation raised by Victor Newman.
I don't watch soap operas because now there's so much other stuff to do than watch soap operas.
Like what?
Like The Vice or other shows. Like, because back then there was only a few channels.
Yes, this child has heard me talk about growing up with hegemony of only 3 TV channels. With her iPad and no understanding of appointment television, we don't have the intergenerational bond of soap watching. I asked my 21-year-old stepdaughter, Raven, if any of her friends watch soaps. I already knew she didn't.
Not that I know of.
You don't.
I don't. I think mostly people, like, I don't know if they're on, like, Netflix or one of the streaming stuff, but, like, most people don't even buy just, like, you're going to get a package deal with the Netflix, Hulu, other streaming services, Amazon Prime. They wouldn't, for the most part, just because it's on your phone, you can put it on your iPad, you can put it on your laptop, things like that. And it's cheaper because people get Fire Sticks now. So now all they have to do is plug it in. Now they got all of the networks.
Well, Raven summed it up. Soaps are inherently ritualized. Although I think the habit of binge watching could in theory be applied to soaps, but there are just so many episodes. The stories don't end. Yet sometimes they are canceled. The most iconic soaps went dark in the aughts. For fans, it's gut-wrenching to say farewell. When Guiding Light was canceled in 2009, it was a big deal. From a 15-minute radio show to an hour television show, lights out on the oldest scripted series. The residents of Springfield said goodbye. At the time, I wrote this huffy tweet comparing CBS to Fox News. Guiding Light was canceled for low ratings, but its viewership was higher than Glenn Beck. Hashtag soap tweet. In 2011, the curtain on my favorite soap came down. All My Children had 11,210 episodes across 41 years. Goodbye, Erica Kane. Goodbye to a piece of my childhood. Today, these daytime soaps remain. Young and the Restless, Bold and the Beautiful, Days of Our Lives, General Hospital, and the most recent addition, Beyond the Gates. General Hospital now holds the distinction of being TV's longest scripted series, created in 1963. Moving from black and white with hospital staff standing around the nurse's station to a sleeker show with organized crime prominent. In 1981, during the Luke and Laura phenomenon, General Hospital had a daily following of 14 million viewers. And then there's The Bold and the Beautiful. It's been the world's most popular soap. It premiered in 1987. A fashion house is the backdrop with the Forrester family at the helm.
Well, we wanted to base it in a real city. So we set it in Los Angeles. We wanted to have the business be something visually stimulating and kind of sexy. So we set it in the fashion business. And it was around that time that the world was opening up to private channels in Europe and, you know, in Africa and Australia. All over. And before that, it was all basically public broadcasting companies. And then when the privatization was allowed, they needed content. And we had a lot of content. And so we were kind of hoping that we might be able to sell this thing globally. But we didn't realize the extent of it.
Bold was created under Bell Phillip Television Productions, named after his parents. And despite the hand-wringing about the future of soaps, I read that Bold is the world's most popular soap opera. Brad Bell confirmed, bucking the notion that soaps are dead or on life support. They found a viable financial model.
I think at our peak, we may have had over 100 countries and maybe 100 million viewers. Italy is our biggest market outside of the United States now. And has been for a while, and they are when the actors go to Italy, they're really recognized everywhere, and they're so sweet, and it's amazingly similar that they will say, "Oh my gosh, it's Brooke or it's Ridge," and then after a moment, 30 seconds of awe, they go right back into, "Why did you do that? And you shouldn't have. And you had Ridge there, and what kind of example are you setting for your daughter?" And it's wonderful to see that, because that is unique in soaps, where they really come down on these characters, and it's sweet, it's endearing.
Today, soaps pull in 2 to 3 million viewers each week, still beating some categories on Fox News Channel. After the break, every soap scene is a love scene.
WBEZ brings you live events year-round. Think performances, workshops, interviews, and more. Whether you're looking to learn, laugh, or be inspired, there's an event for you. Explore what's happening at wbez.org/events.
The origin story of a soap fan generally starts off the same way. A grandmother, a mother, a babysitter, and sometimes a VCR. As viewers, we watch babies be born, matriarchs die. Older women are not pushed off the canvas or replaced with younger actors. We watch their living rooms from our living rooms. Soaps are an immersive world with generations of expansive backstories. The fans debate with the fervor of Marvel devotees and passion of Trekkies at their own conventions. And fans sometimes ran the gamut. Poet Gwendolyn Brooks did not accept phone calls when her stories were on. Warren Buffett wrote Agnes Nixon letters and parlayed his fandom into All My Children cameos. One of Stephanie Sloan's earliest memories is standing in her crib and seeing this logo on her TV screen.
The Edge of Night.
In high school, if she called in sick, her parents accused her of wanting to stay home to watch soaps. At age 21, she got a job at Soap Opera Digest, the magazine she started reading as a preteen.
You know, one of my first jobs was reading fan letters and creating a report about what the fans were talking about that week. Now, I will tell you, by the end, I was still doing that, but I was getting them via email. We did still get letters, but they, more often than not, I would have the same people. There were about, I don't know, 5 or 10 people who would email every week and had an opinion. And the thing that was interesting was, you know, back in the day, you maybe had a friend who you could talk to about your soap, or you had a neighbor that watched it too. And then when the message boards were created, it just opened up the world for people to find like-minded people and talk about, you know, storylines more. And I think in some way it bred a more passionate fan base. And then in some way it bred so much more discontent, because you then had the opportunity to kind of find someone else who agreed with you that that storyline sucked, or I hated that they did that.
Sloan now covers soaps for TV Guide.
I just love the nature that it just doesn't end, that you're on a journey with these characters and that you care about them and you care about what happens to them. So it's hard for me to imagine a world where I wasn't watching soaps, because it's just been such a part of my life. I feel the reason that soaps are still on the air today is the same reason they were popular from the beginning, is that people want to watch characters, families, and situations that mirror their own lives, but are maybe more dramatic or more heightened. And having a cathartic experience of watching this, connecting with people, connecting with characters. Ken Corday would always give me the example of Bill Bell saying, you know, there's two people in a scene in a waterfall, now lose the waterfall. And that's really it. You just want to see the characters. You want to see the storyline. You don't need all the bells and whistles.
Bill's son, Brad, says for him, soaps are about how families ideally should operate. And when they go off the rails, they come back to forgive, love, nurture, and accept. That's what his dad taught him, plus these lessons.
People need to connect emotionally. They just can't watch. You know, these shows can't be plot-driven. Although that's fun, you know, to mix in a plotting story, but they have to be character driven. They come back because they know the characters. Even the villains have to have, you know, some kind of redeeming quality. And I think he said, you know, even when you're arguing and there's fights and there's conflict, that every scene is a love scene, and they're engaged in this, you know, fight because they have passions and they feel strong about their convictions. So I think that every scene is a love scene, is something that I repeat. I don't know if he said it first or not, but I know that was kind of his style.
Dear listeners, have I persuaded you to start watching soaps? I doubt it. That wasn't the point of the podcast, even though I would love it if you joined me over on the robust soap Twitter community. You don't need a VCR to record if you're at work. You can watch on demand. I do hope I convinced you of the importance of daytime serials in American history and their unsung founder, Erna Phillips, who created the genre in 1930. Remember, vixens and cliffhangers bloomed from her imagination. Soaps offer a unique narrative style. It's the television medium's longest-running scripted series with worlds that do not end. Sure, the influence is all over television, but if soaps went off the air, nothing would wholly replace them. There's reality TV. Two soap actresses, Lisa Rinna and Eileen Davidson, have been on The Real Housewives of Beverly Hills.
I know. How are you? I said it. Okay. I said all of it. It was ever.
That changes a lot.
I'm surprised. And I'm disappointed that Lisa Rinna has put herself in this position again.
I really
And of course, telenovelas are indebted to American soaps.
¿Por qué nada? A mí no se me piden cuentas. Eso ya debería saberlo.
Está bien, Rafael. Allá tú con tu conciencia.
Mi conciencia está perfectamente
Actually,
tranquila.
Any international soap played here or on the other side of the globe. Soaps are the foundation for so much television storytelling today. It's the first place that television told continuing serialized stories. Relationships are created with an invested audience, tapping into emotion and drama. Daytime television has long been trivialized. The term soap is a lazy pejorative when someone wants to insult a show. On this journey, I've wanted you to learn about the social issues soaps confronted ahead of their time. Explorations of family and women's issues. Why do I love soap so much? For sure, the enduring love is deeply connected to nostalgia. Soaps also speak to my own cultural sensibilities. I love lowbrow and highbrow art. That's why the late feminist writer Susan Sontag comes to mind for me when I think about soaps. The range of campiness to poignancy is all there on the small screen. How can a genre at one turn embrace tropes and stereotypes? When I was in high school, Janet on All My Children wanted to steal her sister Natalie's man.
Not for me. Oh, you were keeping all those things of Trevor's for you?
Finally, the light bulb's lit.
And not wanting to be in the wedding, that was envy. You couldn't bear to see me marry Trevor because you wanted him?
Right on target. You see, Trevor and I belong together. And we'd be together right now if you hadn't poisoned
me. Messy. Janet throws Natalie down the well and assumes her identity. They were played by the same actress, by the way. Okay, then on the other end of the spectrum, in 1995, Robin on General Hospital, the Robin who was my age when she started as a six-year-old on the soap, tells the uncle who raised her some devastating news.
I asked Ellen to give me the test. And he brought over the results last night. I'm HIV positive.
She contracted HIV from her boyfriend, Stone. He died on General Hospital.
I'm so sorry. It's true.
You have time. You have time, you have strength, you have love, you have courage.
I wonder if
I do. I don't. Look at me. Something else you have is me. Because I swear to you, Robin, I will never let you down.
Robin's teenage diagnosis played out for decades into marriage and motherhood. Again, the form allows this type of storytelling. So there you have it, my love letter and thesis all wrapped into one over these serialized episodes. Now my time with you must come to an end. But if you change your mind, you can tune in today, tomorrow, next week, because these are stories without end. Stories Without End is a production of WBEZ Chicago and part of the NPR network. I'm your host and writer, Natalie Moore. The show is produced by Hina Srivastava and edited by Ariel Van Cleve. It's mixed by Haley Bloomquist. We had music and production assistance from Justin Bull and Dave Mitzka. Thanks to Brendan Banizak. Our executive producer is Tracy Brown. Special thanks to Elena Levine, Andrew Wyatt, Andrea McKinnon, Eva Bassler, Ariane Nettles, Sarah Stark, Susie Yon, Lauren Children, J. Nicole Brooks, Candace Washington, Northwestern University Library, and University of Wisconsin Archives. This podcast is dedicated to Ada Rimes.